Of general peace and relatively philosophical revolution. It is unwise to make precise predictions in advance, but I see no reason why the presidency cannot be kept within the limits of a fourth volume, and the years of retirement covered by a fifth, if the strength of the author and the patience of the publishers and the public will hold out that long. Throughout the months since I wrote the introduction to Jefferson the Virginian, I have kept in mind the purposes that I stated there for the work as a whole, namely that it be comprehensive, and relate the man to his times, and be true to his own chronology. A work of historical biography like this, predominantly narrative in form, does not lend itself to ready summary, but I will make a few observations in the light of these avowed purposes. The goal of comprehensiveness, that is, of showing the whole man and not merely certain segments of him, is difficult of attainment at all stages of Jefferson's career, and is specially so during his years in France. He was a public official, engaged in diplomatic activities which seemed relatively unrewarding at the time, but are of genuine historical importance, since they foreshadowed later policies and attitudes. I trust that I have treated these with sufficient fullness. His time was far less absorbed by routine tasks, however, than it was after he became Secretary of State at home, and the vaunted scene of Europe offered this man of vast energy and curious mind personal opportunities such as he had never had before, and was never to have again. Despite his nostalgia and his sense of the futility of Parisian life, it seems that in France, Jefferson was better able to do the sort of things he wanted to do, and to be the sort of man he wanted to be, than he ever was afterward while in public office. Never again did he live so well, or indulge his tastes so freely. Never again, until his final retirement from public life, could he be to such an extent, and for so long a time, a detached philosopher. He may have preferred the rural atmosphere of Monticello, as he always said he did. But this highly cultivated man became well-oriented in France, and he lived there a life of extraordinary intellectual and spiritual elevation. He was well aware of the dangers implicit in the political and economic situation, but for him this was the hour of the full flowering of the Enlightenment, and he never gave clearer proof of his undying belief that men and society can be saved by means of knowledge. This faith, coupled with a zeal to promote the general good of mankind by an interchange of useful things, provides the clue to his manifold activities. It was not merely that he loved music, though he said it was the favorite passion of his soul. It was not only that he gazed rapturously on beautiful buildings like the Maison Carrée at Nîmes. It was not merely that he found in scientific inquiry a supreme delight. He was primarily concerned with the uses of all these things. His spirit, as I understand it, is best set forth, perhaps, in the chapter entitled Minister of Enlightenment, though there are plenty of clues and examples elsewhere in this book. He believed that men could become free and happy if they came to know more about everything, and there was a utilitarian cast to all his thinking. Thus, when he spread information in Europe about his own country, when he sent home books and architectural drawings, when he reported agricultural conditions in France and Italy and Germany, he was in the fullest sense a public servant. At the same time, this was one of the richest periods of his life in private friendship. He had to argue with the officials of other countries in his efforts to open the channels of trade to his own country, but political controversy imposed no such barriers as it did afterwards at home, and he was free to be what he liked to be, everybody's friend. He had contacts everywhere, though he set slight value on those with the world of fashion, and his most intimate associations, by and large, were with Americans. Without attempting the impossible task of describing all of his associations, I have tried to lay the emphasis where I believe he laid it, on his domestic circle and the Americans who gathered round him as host, patron, and friend. On the little artistic group, which included Maria Causeway, Angelica Church, and Madame de Corny, on Lafayette, and liberal nobles like La Rochefoucauld and Condorcet, who were so close to him in political spirit.